This is what's called a gospel parallels. And I'm using it because I can see the whole story at one time. A gospel parallels is simply taking all three of Matthew, Mark, and Luke, the three gospels, and putting them in parallel columns. We think that Matthew and Luke both had Mark in front of them when they put their gospels together. Because most of what's in Mark is in Matthew and Luke, plus there are other things. So you learn a lot by seeing these relationships, not just trying to reflect on them. Well, I guess we gotta, all this modern technology in the other room, we gotta keep them occupied. We will be studying a couple of Lucan parables, Luke 11:5-8, entitled The Friend at Midnight, and Luke 18:1-8, which I've called The Persistent Widow, and the title is What is the Point of the Story? My name is Vern Fiatta. Lord, prosper our reflections, enable us to understand ourselves and our world and thy purposes, and give us refreshment and healing during our time here. Through Christ our Lord, amen. These, and one other which we may get to or not get to, stories caught my attention because they're odd stories. They don't seem very pious. They're pretty everyday stories, almost proverbial. And at least one of the main character in each of the stories is not very admirable. And so they're not stories that one identifies with simply. They're more complicated to identify with. You sort of have to think about them. I guess I like them because there's a little bit of a riddle to them, and they sort of force us to think our way in and out of them. So that the fellow in both cases, you get action because somebody wants to get somebody off their back, you know, just like a bureaucrat. And they're just quite intriguing. So I wanted us to kind of work at them together, and stories are good for talking about them because everybody gets a little different insight and comes at them in different way. That's the grouping, a group of odd stories. The other thing I want to say to begin with is something about the history of parable research. Right now, I would say that the most important thing to remember about these parables is that a story is a story is a story is a story. When all is said and done, you don't tell a story because you could have preached a sermon, or you don't tell a story because you could have written a poem. You tell a story because you want to tell a story. And one of the things that has happened in the past 50 years is that we are learning to live more comfortably with letting a story be a story. In other words, uh, The old allegorical method of reading stories made all the stories into Christian doctrine. Well, now, if Jesus had wanted to teach doctrine, he could have just gotten out there and taught doctrine. But he told stories. It was a great breakthrough when we decided not to allegorize the stories. So we historicized the stories and made them lessons about Jesus' preaching of the gospel. And that was a big improvement over allegorizing. It was a big improvement to realize that a story has maybe only one point. But still, we spent an awful lot of energy grabbing the point. And we sort of peeled the story off and tried to walk away with the lesson. And lately we're learning to be a little more comfortable with a story that's a story that's a story. And one of the things we ought to talk about is, what is the advantage of a story over a proverb or a lesson or a moral exhortation? Why do people tell stories anyhow? What?
Attention gain.
They're interesting.
They're close to real life.
They can be very realistic.
Entertaining.
Yeah, they keep you awake, don't they?
To make a point.
They sometimes add up to a point. But sometimes they sort of are good stories even if you don't know quite what they mean. Nowadays we hear all kinds of stories and you decide what they mean, but you know they mean more than that. But you sort of remember the story.
There's lots better recall, and then you sometimes tend to share it more with others than you would just a dogma or something.
It's much harder to turn a story into ideas than it is a proverb. Story is somehow about action, about people. And so a story is somehow maybe gets closer to us, maybe gets to our sense of identity, so that even if we don't know quite what the point is, once we've heard the story, we don't look at it with the same eyes. We are somehow... I guess one way to put it is, when you walk through a story, after you have walked through a story, you aren't the same person. The story has become a part of you, storytelling there are lots of reasons for doing it. It wasn't, Jesus did quite a lot of it, in fact. It's very difficult, since almost all of the experience, the early Christians' experience of Jesus was briefly memories of the historical Jesus. A few of them were around when Jesus was preaching. But a good deal of it is experience of remembering the preaching of Jesus under the influence of the Spirit and in the power of the resurrection. And so it's very difficult to separate the first memories of Jesus from what Jesus means to the community. I think it's impossible modern biblical critics have tried to pull apart and say, this is Jesus and this is the early Christians. And theologians have worked very hard at this, and if you're for the church, then you try to get all your eggs in the Jesus basket, and if you're against the church and for some moral vision of Jesus, you try to get all your eggs divided up differently. But the fact of the matter is, it's very difficult to pull these apart. Pull these apart. With the stories, we are have as much consensus about them going back to the ministry of Jesus as anything. So that the stories suggest that Jesus was a teaching figure, a cryptic, a prophetic type figure, and so on. So that they're also interesting from that respect. Now, in that sense, Jesus as storyteller stands in a long tradition. I want to just read you one of my favorite Old Testament stories, which comes from 2 Samuel 12. David has been kind of a nasty guy, and the prophet is sent to sort of confront him and be his conscience. The Hebrew society had a system where prophets tried to prick the conscience of the king. You didn't leave it to the journalist to expose Watergate. You had prophets who were there to sort of keep tabs on whether the use of power measured up to the covenant expectations. And so Nathan goes to see David. And Nathan tells a story. This is kind of interesting because Nathan is making up a story. David thinks he's presenting a case because in that kind of a patriarchal society, the people who had cases tried, the king was sort of the Supreme Court, as well as the commander-in-chief. There was all his power centered in one figure. And so the prophet would bring in a cause to the king, and then the king would resolve it. Then the Lord sent Nathan to David. He came to him and said to him, there were two men in a certain city, one rich and the other poor. The rich man had many flocks and herds, but the poor man had nothing but one little ewe lamb, which he had bought. And he brought it up, and it grew up with him and with his children, and it used to eat of his morsel and drink from his cup and lie in his bosom, and it was like a daughter to him. Now there came a traveler to the rich man, and he was unwilling to take one of his own flock or herd to prepare for the wayfarer who had come to him, but he took the poor man's lamb and prepared it for the man who had come to him. Clear case of the rich wanting to keep his riches, clear case of kind of economic exploitation. Then David's anger was hotly kindled against the man, and he said to Nathan, as the Lord lives, the man who has done this deserves to die. Notice, as long as it was a story out there, David was very clear in his judgment about right and wrong. One of the big advantages of a story is that it's also not so close to home, but you can see it. It's not close enough to home that you put your finger on the scales. In other words, put it this way. If I have a big stake in something, I'm going to pick the scales that come out in my favor. I'm going to pick the scales where I get the 13th, where I get a dozen of 13 rather than a dozen of 11. And so seeing oneself is an enormously difficult project. It's an enormously difficult project. Not to either see oneself as hero or see oneself as victim. It seems to me we're plagued with either wanting to be, to look and reassure ourselves that we're doing something worthwhile, or reassure ourselves that we're really worse off than everybody else. And it's just devilishly hard to kind of look at ourselves straightly. Anyhow, so the stories help. The stories help because they get inside of us, but they're also far enough away that they're not as threatening as thou shalt not. And so stories are kind of fun. Anyhow, what happened in this? I should. Nathan said to David, "You are the man. Thus says the Lord God of Israel, I anointed you king over Israel. I delivered you out of the hand of Saul. I gave you your master's house, your master's wives, into your bosom. Gave you the house of Israel." You know, in those days, David could have had as many wives as he wanted. The real problem with David and Bathsheba was not that David was sexy, but that David took the wife of a man who had only one wife, when he could have increased the harem. He had gotten his father's Saul's harem, and he could have increased it by fair means as well as foul. So, okay, stories are stories are stories. So there's a long tradition of prophetic storytelling in Israel, and it's not strange that Rabbi Jesus would have told stories. And what is strange is that there isn't. It's going to be a little harder to find who we identify with in these stories. The Good Samaritan, you know, it's easy with the Good Samaritan, the Pharisee, and the publican, but these are a little more cryptic. Which of you, now it's Luke 11, 5 through 8. Now let's get at the story. Which of you who has a friend will go to him at midnight and say to him, "Friend, lend me 3 loaves, for a friend of mine has arrived on a journey and I have nothing to set before him"? Pretty ordinary situation for them. We were musing on it at breakfast after the first round, after the staff round, on what was going on. One thing that's going on is, of course, no motels, no Holiday Inn. If you travel from one town to another, you put up with friends of friends. The Greeks had a system of family friends, and so when you went to this town, you went to that family, and they were hospitable to you. There was exchange. And then they would come and bum off you when they came to your town. So it was you paid in kind, but you didn't pay in cash. And it was a nice system. It seems to have broken down lately in modern society, but it still works to a degree. I think you're all making the rounds of your connections and avoiding the professional ends. So it still holds to some degree. At any rate, the friend arrived, and the other thing, of course, is he can't go to the deep freeze, nor the refrigerator. This is a society in which you tend not to pile up. When I think of some of have you ever had the experience of, you know, you buy all the bargains at the grocery store? I mean, you got to buy the peas while they're on sale, and of course you got to buy the chickens when they're half price. And pretty soon, you've got a house, and you actually have enough food for a month. When we were cleaning out our cupboards ready to go, we found a couple of things that we've had in the house for 20 years. And they were so old that we put them up as decoration. Well, this isn't a society, you know, if it's hot weather and things like that, and this isn't that kind of a storage society. So that it's perfectly normal for you not to have any food in the house. You will have eaten your day's bread, and you don't want day-old bread, and you haven't started tomorrow's bread. So it's perfectly normal. It isn't that the people, there was something wrong with the people, that they didn't have food in their house at night. They just normally didn't have food in their house, so that they were going to the neighbor who maybe had a bigger house or was a friend and maybe had to have a little leftover and this kind of thing. Because you would have to feed the people before they go into bed. So you go to your friend, knock, knock. Don't bother me. The door is locked up. My children are with me in bed. I cannot get up and give you anything. Great friend. Friend from 9 to 5, but not after supper. But, you know, by the time in a complicated society, by the time you do the lockup, by the time you get your children bedded down, if you're all sleeping in one room, to get up and hassle all this stuff is going to wake up the household. You know, for goodness sakes, you don't need to eat at midnight. I mean, then the other guy didn't have such a big... It wasn't an emergency. It's not like it was somebody who was beat up or somebody was having a baby, or it's not like their cow was sick. It was just that they wanted some food, and who needs food at midnight? So forget it. Go away, you know. You're asking me to wake up the whole household for nothing. So it's a kind of story full of the realism about the conveniences and mostly inconveniences of life. Then it has a punchline. Though he will not get up and give him anything because he is his friend, yet because of his importunity, he will rise and give him whatever he needs. Because of his importunity. Well, I know what the word opportunity means, but I hardly ever have used the word importunity. So, what is importunity? Inconvenience? Think of anything else?
Persistence?
Pestiness. Inconvenience because of his
nagging,
untimeliness, and that's sort of true. You know, there are all kinds of times that you really don't want to do something, and somebody comes along and catches you off guard, and there you are doing something that you really had not planned on doing. And it's through no goodwill, it's through no altruism, it's through no love of God. It's just that you got trapped into doing it and you didn't know how to say no, and you want them off your back as soon as you can. And life sort of works that way. And that's what the story is about. Just imagine that. And then it goes on. Luke puts this little story, which is kind of realism, it almost could be a story, is even if people don't want to do something for you, try anyhow, then you might be able to pester them into doing it. Put a little pressure on, you might get somewhere. Might not too, but you just might. Don't spend so much time preaching at them, just put a little heat on and see if you can get what you want out of them. Now that doesn't sound like a Bible story, does it? But there it is. There it is. Now Luke, when he puts it together with something, he doesn't want to come out and say that Jesus was telling him to be pesty, so he ties it into prayer. Ask and it will be given you. Seek and you will find. Knock and it will be opened unto you. For everyone who asks receives. He who seeks finds. And to him who knocks it will be opened. And so on. Well, that is a story about persistence. Whether you persist in prayer, or whether you persist in social justice, or whether you persist in trying to get food for your family, it seems to be a story about persistence being a helpful thing. Well, I have another story that's kind of like that, and that's the one that I think I'll get us involved in the discussion of, and that's the parable of the persistent widow, Luke 18, 1 through 8. Now that story was easy to, that was kind of simple. There wasn't much frame around that story. In fact, there wasn't any frame at all. The key to reading the parables of Jesus is to begin with the story. And then see what the frames do to the story. Most times when people read the parables, they look at the frame, reduce the story to the frame, and never hear the story. Now, it's my contention that in order to get the force of the parable, you have to hear the story. You have to see the story before you see the frame. So that, or you have to go through the frame and focus on the story and then begin to see what the frames do to it. So we will work at this story sort of by itself and then put the frames back on it. And you'll see what I'm getting at. Why is that? It's because when a story is remembered, you put a tag on it about what it meant to you. But the thing about a story, it's like Lake Chelan or Crater Lake, the thing about a story is that it can mean something to you and something to you. It can mean something to my grandmother, and it can mean something to me. The thing about a story is that it can keep being reframed. The story stands, is there, and the frames keep going on, so that you can have several good frames for the same story. And you know how when you go to get a frame nowadays and you have colored frames, if you use this frame, it'll bring out one color in the picture. And if you use that frame, it brings out another color in the picture. And if you use that frame, it brings these two colors out. Well, a story is like a picture. It's got a lot of colors in it. So that the frame is never as rich as the story. So if you collapse the story into the frame, you miss the depth kind of the story. Well, and he told them a parable to the effect that they ought always to pray and not lose heart. But here's the story. In other words, notice that the frame is tying this as Luke did. Well, this is Luke. Tying it to persistence in prayer. In a certain city there was a judge who neither feared God nor regarded the human condition. Who neither paid attention to God nor paid attention to human values. What was he doing as a judge anyhow? Well, a judge resolves social conflicts. A judge is supposed to not only pay attention to ideals of justice, but to pay attention to social pressures. And it's not everybody who practices law is an idealist. There are a lot of people in politics and law who are in there because it helps the society keep going, and they don't worry too much either about eternal values or human values. So there was a judge, a plain ordinary judge, not particularly heroic, not, again, key figure is a perfectly ordinary, not very admirable type. And there was a widow in that city who kept coming to him. Remember that verse in James that one of the great obligations of the Christian community was to visit the fatherless and the widows in their affliction. Why? Because the fatherless, the people who had no male parent, and the widows who had no spouse, had no voice in the society, like a situation where a woman couldn't vote or hold property in her own name. The access to justice was via the male kin. So you had to get your son, or you had to get your brother, or your brother-in-law, or your father, so that the widow is the one who doesn't have immediate access. So she is being a fairly pesty, persistent, sturdy type to go in there and keep asking for justice herself. And she needs the help of the judge, because she has nobody to go strong-arm the guy who ran over her cow or took away part of her field. She has no male protector to go do that for her. So she needs the... And the real business of government in a covenant society is to care for the people who don't have voice. In a society where most people can get justice because they have the power to get justice, the business of the king or the business of the government is to help the people that can't get it because they do not have the power. The business of the parent of the society is to care for the person in the society who does not have the social power to get their due. It isn't the rich people or the landed people or the clan people who need the help of the government as much as it is the dispossessed, the disenfranchised, and so forth. Now, so that the real way you tell the difference between a far-sighted government and a narrow-sighted government is the far-sighted government, the narrow-minded government, just pays attention to the people who have power. The far-sighted government pays attention to the people who are powerless. Who are powerless. And not just the people who have power. Because the more people that you leave out of the society, the more unstable the society becomes. The more oppressive the society becomes. The more the group of alienated people increases, the less likelihood that the society can operate fairly. So a far-sighted government tends to the people who are on the outside of social power, because they are the people who finally can bring down any government. The power people may keep a dictator in position, but finally the stability of the society depends on the well-being of the masses. And so, anyhow, there was a widow in the city who kept coming to him and saying, "Vindicate me against my adversary." For a while he refused, but afterward he said, "Though I neither fear not God nor regard human beings, yet because this widow bothers me, I'll vindicate her, or she will wear me out by her coming. I don't worry about what God thinks of me, if there is a God. I've got my judgeship for life. I don't have to worry about what these people say. Oh, that's not my problem. But she's a pest, and the only way to get her off her back is to solve her problem for her." Now, what's that story about? What's the point of the story?
Persistence.
in terms of, yes, the woman kept coming. Can you make it a little more concrete than that? It is in very general terms about persistence. Persistence, but, you know, you can be persistent about making money, you can be persistent about weeding your garden, you can be persistent about saying your prayers.
Could be demanding.
What?
Demanding.
It did bring justice to her.
She got her problem solved, according to the story. Well, it certainly is not a story that says, shut up and be timid and the Lord will take care of you. It is not a story about, clearly not a story about sitting around and hoping for the best. Or...
just action.
Yeah, notice, that's one of the problems of the text. This is really a story about a pretty assertive, in the one case, somebody who was being hospitable, and in this case, a pretty assertive woman trying to take care of her family. It's not a story about, that's one of the ironies, is the frame says be persistent in prayer. But if you just look at the story, it suggests being a lot more assertive than praying. It suggests being really persistent in your action.
Isn't the story more about the person judging them?
Yeah, the story is a lot about the person judging. What do you get out of the person judging?
That there's a limit to how much judgment can take.
Unpack that. That sounds pretty good.
That if you go by expediency, there's a limit. That you reach a limit and you have to give in.
So if you're a normal, pragmatic realist, you really got to do a little good anyhow just to save your skin. Well, a judge is kind of an interesting figure. It's kind of a Pontius Pilate figure, kind of a pragmatist who... that's kind of interesting, yeah. So even if society has people in it who are not particularly Christian or not motivated by covenant values, it can work.
In the secular world, there's a saying, you know, that the squeaking wheel gets the grease. And I've seen that happen in offices and human situations time and time again. The guy that keeps...
Well, that's interesting because I think that's exactly the proverb that fits the story. But it's not a secular, I mean, it's actually a religious insight. In other words, the funny thing about this story is that it looks like common sense. And it's interesting that Jesus would have majored in common sense, and not just theology.
I'm up in the balcony. I'm wondering, is there any importance in these stories that the things that the people were being persistent about were of value in themselves, that hospitality was highly valued in that society, so to have somebody help be hospitable to the guest in the middle of the night was a reasonable, valid thing to ask, and justice was certainly a reasonable thing. I wonder, are there any of these kinds of stories where the person is asking for something that really isn't in itself inherently good, and the persistence helps?
Yeah, I've got one more, and I don't know whether we'll get to it, but we could do it tomorrow. But the one that does fit you're right. In both of these two stories, the underdog in the story is meeting a need. They are valid human needs, and so one of the highlights of the story is that it validates persistence in meeting human needs. One of the highlights in the story is that it does. It validates the it shows you how to work the system, even judges. The story that is different than this is Luke 13, 1 through 7, the story of the unjust steward, where the guy is commended for reducing the bill. He got fired. He's an account, you know, he has a bunch of accounts. He got fired because he wasn't doing very good for the boss, and so he went around and gave a discount on all the bills to all the people. So it literally gave him a handout, so he would have some people to grease his palm when he lost his job. So in that case, the need is not admirable. It's understandable. He's going to be unemployed and he's trying to keep from going hungry. But it's not admirable to cheat his employer. Whereas it is admirable to get food for a friend, and it is admirable to stand up for your rights.
But is the purpose of that parable about the steward anywhere near the same? Is it saying be persistent in feathering your own nest? These two seem to be very clearly the messages: be persistent and supposedly persisting in relationship to importuning God. But I'm wondering if that parable ever had that same sense of purpose. That was the sermon this Sunday, so it was
unjust steward. No, but what's similar, it seems to me, is that shrewdness, we don't normally think of either shrewdness or persistence as Christian virtues. You know, we normally think of self-sacrifice, of service. We don't normally think of things as assertive as shrewdness and persistence. So there's a little bit of similarity between them. In other words, but you're quite right, they're different. They're not the same story. Like the friend at midnight and the persistent widow are the same thing.
Maybe another way of expressing it would be that they both approached it single-mindedly.
Now, there's a lot of affirmation about common prudence in these. Persistence, shrewdness. Do you see any... what's all this got to do with God? One of the frames if you were an early Christian and thinking about what this had to do with being Christian, so far we've just so sort of talked about what the story had to do with being human. I mean, Christians ought to be shrewd and Christians ought to be persistent, but they have no corner on it. Muslims and Jews and Buddhists and other people ought to be just as persistent and shrewd as Christians. You know, those are sort of human, those are sort of universal human values. And in one sense, the story has a lot of universality to it. If you want to make this story say something Christian, what do you do with it?
Just think how much greater is God than our human thinking.
Okay, that's a neat one. Jeff?
The effectual fervent prayer of a righteous man availeth much. Spirit, you know, approaching the throne of God and with, persistence as an attitude, maybe not, well, even knocking hard and saying, hey.
Clearly, if you're into prayer, being persistent in prayer, and not just tapping, is one of the points. I mean, if you're into getting your due, then don't just go once to court, but go five times till you get your due. If you're praying, don't just sit there and say, knock one morning, but better do it for the month. This whole notion so in a sense, I think you're right, there is a strong, this notion of intensity and affirmation can spill over in a lot of directions. And we know from the first line here that they ought always to pray and not lose heart. That clearly one of the lessons to be drawn from the story is to keep at the Christian tasks. The world changes very slowly, if at all. A great many things that we pray for, a great many feature aspects of God's purposes that are revealed to us simply do not get realized easily or quickly. And if you do a productivity test on your Christian experience, you'll quit rather soon. Because the number of miracles you get per hour of prayer is relatively small. And you get more miracles by working than you do by praying. So that there's a, in other words, there is at the gut of Christian community a commitment to do certain things because they need doing, not because they do get results. You say your prayers not simply because prayers change things, but because you have to pray. Prayer is part of the devotion and the life of and consciousness of the community. And there's a difference between the core of the community who knows that certain things have to be done, whether they feel like it, whether they get anything out of it, whether you get quick results. There's a difference between the core of the community and the fringe of the community who do it as long as they get something out of it and then quit. And I think the difference between what I would call following and discipleship is the difference between, is the discovery of the commitment to the gut experience of the community rather than to quick results. So that's important. I think your comment was right on. The bottom, you picked up on the top frame. One ought always to pray and not faint. You picked up on the bottom frame. And will not God vindicate his elect? I tell you, he will vindicate them speedily. Both of these stories are what I would call part of the group of how much more, the how much more stories. If this is the way the world works all by itself, don't you think God can do better? If a perfectly secular judge will come forth with a bit of justice, just for convenience, Don't you think God can do more than that? Now, these are kind of intriguing stories for that reason. They're not telling you what God will do. They're really sort of saying, well, can't God do better than that? Where's your faith? If you so clothe the grass of the field, the lilies of the valley, the birds of the air, then you're going to take care of it? So they're curiously, there's a curious, what I would call a theological backlash that goes with these sort of common sense stories that kind of jars us, maybe even laughs us into it. Because it is sort of funny how little we expect of God. It's sort of funny. Well, those have been prize comments. Got some more?
I just heard you say on one hand that we expect too little of God. And then, on the other hand, I hear you say we should pray daily and do our devotions daily, whether we feel like it or not, and we may never see, and the returns on that are small, but we do it because we're told to, and that confuses me.
God's timing is always right. It may not be the right time immediately.
Well, I guess I see it more of a, like maintaining a house. If you need to work on it daily just to keep the house maintained. You can be persistent in some, you can do projects, but you need to keep the maintenance there just to keep things going. If you let it slip and you don't maintain it, it may take a little while, but then you're going to step back and see the place is a mess. And sort of the same thing with our prayer life. Unless we keep up with it daily, you're going to step back and see how far you slip. Maybe in a sense, I see more of, you don't see the results until you step back. And maybe the daily results of prayer aren't always as obvious, but they are definitely there. All you have to do is step back a little from it.
And you may never, but you may never see the results.
Well, you can see the results by stopping and seeing what the results of stopping are. And you do experience that.
Some people do. Some people don't.
I think of a woman in a congregation where I grew up who prayed for like 20 years. Her husband had no interest in the church. And he became a Christian, but it took like 20 years.
Well, it's a paradox, isn't it? Sometimes yes, it will come immediately, you know, because God's hands are open towards us, but on the other hand, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'm really intrigued by your initial question, and I don't know if I can fit the two things together. But I think there are two kinds of insights here that both of which the story, in fact, I'm really seeing three levels of insight from the one story. You know how nowadays they have fancy medications, they can give you one pill and part of it acts for the first 2 hours and part of it acts for the next 4 hours and so on. When my dad first got diabetes, he just had to take pills all the time, and then he took one pill a day because they had that delayed action effect. Well, stories are a little bit like that. They have a point, and then they have another point, and then they have another point. And I just think stories are not consistent. Stories are just deep. And they don't run dry, in other words. And looked at from one angle, you may see something quite different than looked at from another angle. And that's true, too. So that... but there is a difference. Okay, let's see if I can point out the difference. Persistence. It's important. It sometimes gets results, and it sometimes doesn't. But waking up to the wisdom of being assertive, whether you're being assertive like the original stories in terms of taking care of your friends or taking care of justice issues, or whether you're being assertive as the second generation Christians were in terms of keeping at the prayer of their congregation and trying to care for the Christian community, the story seems to affirm and bless and suggest that it's okay to be assertive. In fact, it's probably desirable to be assertive. In fact, it helps make the world work, because a lot of people will not budge unless somebody else takes the initiative. There are a lot of passive people in the world. And to make the world work, you need some assertive people. And to make your world work, prudence dictates a certain kind of persistence. Now, having said that, day in and day out, we need to exercise lots of common sense and practical wisdom and lots of guts and courage. Having said that, it seems to me the other point is God isn't just a matter of common sense. If you only expect God from God what you can get out of an unjust judge, if you only can expect from God what you get out of a friend who's half a friend, who's only a friend till he puts his kids to bed, then your vision of what of God in life is too small. There's a difference between what we must be about to make our life work and what we must be open to see happening in God. That in fact, God is free. He doesn't live by our rules, or she doesn't live by our rules. God is spirit and moves and is free to pull surprises, to do turnarounds, to get at problems in ways that we would never dream of. So that, and I see some Christians who are all prudence. And I see some Christians who are all waiting for the surprises. The interesting thing about this story is you can spin both. One of the interesting things about the story is that it is both a story about what it's about, but it's also a story which says, because the characters are kind of funny characters, obviously God can do better than that. Yeah.
I was thinking along the same lines in response to this question. When it says okay, from an unjust judge and a poor neighbor, you will get at least a modicum of justice and hospitality. How much more will you get from God? Our tendency is to say that how much more will be lots of justice or lots of hospitality. But along with what you're saying, what we may get that is so much greater may not look a thing like justice or hospitality to us. And that is the point at which we've been praying persistently for justice or aid in hospitality, and we don't get that prayer answered. And what these stories may be saying is, maybe you're not praying for the right thing or enough, or maybe it's just great that God is not going to give you what you're praying for because God has something better to offer. And that, I think, is consistent in the story, that you pray, you're supposed to pray for what you think you need to get. And be very persistent and faithful in that. But you also, as you say, have to be open to say, to seeing that what you get may be something infinitely, literally, infinitely different than what you thought you wanted. And it would not feel like an answered prayer from our limited perspective.
That in fact, there may be answers which we don't even see.
We always want a yes answer, and it's no as an answer to.
And we may not, I mean, this is a funny way to put it, but we may not be tuned in to God's sense of humor. In other words, this I am fascinated. I think Larry Rasmussen is one of the drollest phenomenon in captivity. And it's amazing how much it helps to it helps to be serious, but it also helps immeasurably not to be serious. And there's something about this story that strikes me as be very serious about your business. Be very serious about just causes. Be very serious about your praying. But for goodness sakes, don't take yourself seriously. For goodness sakes, for God's sake, be open to God dealing with you, not as heavy-duty artillery, but as a sort of mixed-up, bumbling kid. And that all, it sort of does fit together, even though it's two different things.